This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we remember South Dakota Senator Jim Aberesik, who recently passed away at age 92.
Jim Aberesik was one of the great progressive populist senators in American history, responsible for opposing the war in Vietnam, advocating for Native American rights, many other things. We speak with both of his children, Charlie and Alia, about his life.
We'll also speak with former San Francisco DA Chesabuddin, who's continuing his good work in his role heading up the new Criminal Law and Justice Center at Berkeley Law.
You can't keep a good man down. The bad guys got rid of him in San Francisco, and he's back now with a center that's quite impressive.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
South Dakota Senator Jim Aberesik was an important figure in American politics. He died 4 months ago at age 92. Aberesik was the son of immigrants from Lebanon. He grew up on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Politically, he was part of the radicalization of the 1960s. He served one term in the U.S. House of Representatives and another in the United States Senate. Elected in 1973, Aberesik fought for policies that are crucially important today. He was against the American imperial power and opposed the war in Vietnam. He tried to rein in the murderous CIA. He attempted to break up the powerful big oil companies. He fought for Native American rights and for the normalization of American relations with Cuba, a government the CIA had been trying to overthrow since the Cuban Revolution of 1959. After 6 years, despite extreme pressure from those who supported him, he left the Senate, disgusted by the power wielded by the moneyed influence of big business. Jim Aberesik went back to South Dakota and back to his law practice. Aberesik found the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee because the oppression of Arabs faced both in the United States and abroad, particularly in Palestine. We speak today with his son, attorney Charlie Aberesik, and his daughter, Alia, who is an architect in Manhattan. We want to acknowledge the contribution to this show of attorney Abdin Jabara, who wrote the introduction and helped with the interview questions. Abdin Jabara is the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and a former law partner of me, Michael Smith. Our first guest is attorney Charlie Aberesik from Rapid City, South Dakota. He's a trial attorney and a longtime activist and community organizer in the Native American community in South Dakota. He's also a documentary filmmaker. His most recent is the feature-length documentary, A Tattoo on My Heart, The Warriors of Wounded Knee, 1973, which played on public television stations around the United States. He's the current Chief Justice of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe's Supreme Court and a member of the South Dakota Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. His client base is made up largely of Native Americans, tribal schools, and Indian tribal governments, but he also represents plaintiffs in civil rights litigation. Attorney Charlie Aberesik, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to appear.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you back on the show, Charlie. Jim Aberesik's advocacy for Native Americans is one of the great legacies of his political career. Can you tell us what exactly he did and what impact it had for Native Americans?
Yes, and actually the question is very timely because just this morning the U.S. Supreme Court in a 7-2 decision upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act, of which he was the primary Senate author. That was a nice way to see his legislative legacy affirmed by that decision this morning, written by Amy Coney Barrett, of all people. I was happy to see that. But generally, you know, he was an advocate from the very beginning. While he was still in the House, he helped form the American Indian Policy Review Commission because he had been told it was important to substantiate with data and so on why more legislation and help for Indian tribes and Indian people was needed. So he set about with this commission in the House. Then they issued numerous volumes in a report. As a result of that, he pushed to get a subcommittee in the House under Scoop Jackson's primary committee, and then went on to, when he was elected to the Senate, he pushed to get the established the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs, of which he was the first chairperson, which transformed into the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. So he set out right away to build a niche for the rights of American Indians in the United States. And that continued on with specific legislative work, first with the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act, which allowed tribes to contract and take over services formerly provided by the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Service and other agencies and departments of the United States government. And then after that, he followed with the American Indian Freedom of Religion Act, which only had the effect of resolution. But as a part of that effort, he was able to get Chief Frank Foolscroll, who was a member of the Oglala Lakota or Sioux tribe, in to do a prayer in the Senate. He was the first Native American. And that was followed by the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978, which has proven to be a saving grace for many Indian children throughout the United States. And so I think that was his impact, and his legislation still stands up today. You know, that those acts have been amended to make them better over the years or to make changes, but overall they've withstood the test of time.
Charlie, what can you tell us about Senator Aberezic's fight against big oil and natural gas deregulation?
Well, he was a longtime critic of the power of the big oil companies. And when there was an effort to deregulate the price of natural gas, he realized immediately that it would have a very severe impact on poor and working people in America. And he set out to oppose that. And when it appeared he couldn't get the votes, he and Senator Howard Metzenbaum from Ohio undertook a filibuster, which was one of the longest in Senate history, as I understand it. And it was only ended through the efforts of President Carter and Vice President Mondale, who, as I understand it, subverted him and Howard Metzenbaum in the filibuster. But that went on for quite some time, and that I think was just indicative of his commitment to the poor and the working people in the United States, and his opposition to the power of big corporations, particularly oil and the natural gas.
You know, I read and then I reread his wonderful memoir, Advice and Dissent, and he talks about how he came to the Congress to represent people. He was not a tool whatsoever of any of the big lobbies, and the natural gas fight sure exemplifies that. He was a genius. He learned the rules of the Senate immediately, and he could play them. And I think that explains how he could have handled that filibuster for as long as it lasted.
He told me he studied Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who knew the Senate rules better than anybody, and he saw the power in understanding those rules and using them effectively for the people rather than the corporations and the big donors.
Yeah, it's just wonderful the way he relates these stories in his memoir, which is still available, Advice and Dissent. And I would encourage our listeners to get it and read it, full of lessons and humor. Charlie, Senator Aberezic has a statewide referendum process in South Dakota. He got that through, which represents true democracy. What were Jim's attempts to make this apply to the whole of America?
Well, I didn't even know about it. I was going through the Smithsonian one day, and they had this huge display of the progress of democracy in America. And the last thing they had was a bill he had authored and fought for to create a national referendum process where people in the various states could petition to have laws passed in a way as a direct or pure democracy, bypassing the Congress. And of course it was defeated, but that was the last display in the history of democracy saying that perhaps someday the United States will have that kind of power placed in the hands of the people. And so he, you know, he, that was just part of his commitment. I mean, you might call it progressive populism in a way, but he was just committed to equalizing the power of corporations and the wealthy and placing more power in the hands of the people. And, you know, I think if, as I look back, perhaps if he'd been more successful or the country had seen to do that, we wouldn't have had more recent phenomena like Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. I think that we perhaps the working people would have been more supportive of legislation if they had been treated more fairly and brought into the government more and served more by our government rather than just primarily serving the special interests and the wealthy.
Jim was passionately against the war in Vietnam. What did he do to support his anti-war activities in the U.S.?
Well, he was committed at all levels. He you know, he helped pass the War Powers Act. He fought the Vietnam War from the very beginning and was very vocal about it. And he did it at the ground level, too. I remember I went out there with him when he first won as a senior in high school. I left, you know, not long after I graduated. But I remember one night during the anti-war demonstrations in D.C. in 1971 in the spring, they had arrested somewhere around 10,000 demonstrators and were holding them in RFK Stadium and other places in Washington. And I was, of course, one of the demonstrators. But one night he asked me if I wanted to go with him down to the courthouse because they were holding arraignments 24/7 during that and running people through. And he went in, and that night he used his authority as a member of Congress to try to get people released under personal recognizance, under his recognizance. He probably helped bond out, I'd say, over 200 to 300 demonstrators as we sat there through the night. He was committed at all levels, and he and I had long, deep talks about Vietnam. Of course, I was very concerned about it because I was almost draft age at that point. So,
yeah, really, same applied to me. Jim was close friends with another great South Dakota senator who passed away in the last years. Can you tell us about Jim's relation with Senator George McGovern?
Yes, I think my dad didn't have too many idols, but George McGovern was one of them. And he loved George. He enjoyed working with him. You know, just really admired him. As a matter of fact, 2 years ago, before he passed, he gave me a couple photos, and one was a big frame photo of him and George McGovern facing each other in a booth at a cafe in Mitchell, South Dakota. And George McGovern had signed an inscription to him, and he said, "That's my favorite photo." He said, "I want you to have it." I think they were a good team for South Dakota back then, and a good team for the nation as well.
Well, back in those days, South Dakota, of course, was a very Republican state. How did it come about that South Dakota got two very progressive Democrats serving in the U.S. Senate?
Well, I only have my own theories, but first of all, South Dakota is not as conservative as it looks. People vote Republican because their parents did, but other than the people that have moved in recently because of Governor Noem, I think that overall South Dakotans have a lot of common sense, and even if they vote Republican for their leaders, for the most part, when you bring up issues one at a time, they tend to vote very progressive on those issues, and still do today. So that's one thing. But secondly, as I think that the gift of both George McGovern and my father was that they were teachers and they respected the constituency. They wouldn't just read the polls and play it safe. They would go out and talk to people and try to change their minds on issues and try to educate them on issues. And they, you know, my dad acted as if people really knew everything, that they would change their mind. And he persisted that way all through his political career. And McGovern was a different kind of a teacher, but still a teacher. And his father was a Presbyterian minister. He was a history professor himself. And I know my father's sort of pedagogy came from the fact that he was the first member of his family who had been kind of conservative to go to college and graduate from college. And when he went to through college, I think it just blew his mind. He loved it so much, and he was so turned on, and he fell in with a group of Democrats. He had the kind of personality, if it excited him, he thought it would excite everybody. And I think that's part of what made him a successful politician, along with being a good people person, is he loved to get out there and talk about issues and teach people. And we don't see that as much anymore. It's all donations and all done on the phone, poll driven. I think that the progressive agenda in America would do a lot better if we respected the working class and the middle class and went out and tried to teach them again.
One of Jim Aberezek's Senate colleagues once remarked that Jim could start a riot in an empty room. In his first and only term in the Senate, how was Jim able to garner support for his positions? You think it's his personality and the way he talked and made friends with people?
He did that. When he was with people, he was charming. He had a great smile, and he because he genuinely liked being in public and being with people. You know, the thing is he was very, in an odd way, you know, open to learning, but also once he arrived at his position on an issue, he didn't deviate from it very much. And he just had a conscience, and he could not stand corruption, for example. I know that from his whole life, he was like that. And if he saw it, he would call it out because he was so offended that somebody would be corrupt or would be unfair or pick on little people or whatever. And he would lose his sense of being careful in groups when it came to those issues. And that's how, I think, probably why he was considered to be the kind of person that could start a riot in an empty room. Because, you know, he that's just the way he was. And, he had no reverse. And, you know, sometimes that didn't serve him well, but a lot of times it did, especially when the power structure was trying to intimidate him. That almost made him more enthusiastic about what he was doing.
Little known today, Charlie, is that Jim introduced legislation that would allow for the appointment of a special prosecutor. We have Biden appointing Jack Smith, who's now investigating the actions of former President Donald Trump. That legislation passed and became the law of the land. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, I think that probably came out of his observation of what the Nixon administration was doing in various activities. And he was, of course, on Nixon's enemy list, was just really had strong feelings about the corruption and the abuse of power in the Nixon administration.
He had a wonderful sense of humor. All the stories that he relates in his book, Advice and Dissent, testify to that. And I wanted to ask you about that. Can you recall some examples of Jim Aberezek's sense of humor?
Yeah, he was, most of the time it was directed at himself. He had a great sense of humor. My mother did too. he was engaged in serious business in the Senate on behalf of the people. But he always said you have to be able to laugh at yourself too. So, you know, I think for a lot of people, he was fun to be around in a kind of a rigid institution like the Senate. You know, you do have to kind of keep your sense of humor, because it's being a progressive in America is a long-term project, and it's not going to happen in one lifetime. And you can't do it without keeping yourself going too. So I think that was part of why he maintained such a good sense of humor.
I remember one of the stories in his book. On election eve, somebody asked him, what would you do if you were elected? And he said, I'd demand a recount.
Yeah, I was. One story I'd never heard at the memorial was Jimmy Colker, who works for the State Department and has been an ambassador. Jimmy was, of course, a close aide to him. And Jimmy reminded us of a story where he was doing a lot of traveling, gone to Cuba and other places. And so a right-wing journalist in Rapid City at a press conference was trying to trap him and says, you know, something like, now that you're an international figure, and then she asked a question. And he said, well, I thought I had a pear-shaped figure. He was just, you know, that's how he would deal with those kind of attacks. But he had the right wing out here on him all the time, and he was pretty good at slipping out of the news repeatedly and staying true to his principles.
Can you tell us a little bit about your grandparents, Jim's parents? They were extraordinarily accomplished, went out to South Dakota, set up a store, and actually made a living. Can you talk about the hardships of those days and what it was like for your grandparents?
Yeah, I wish I had known my grandfather. I was born like a year or so after he passed away, but I knew my grandmother very well and lived with her a lot. You know, they were hard workers, and she had lived in complete poverty in Lebanon after she had a couple kids with my grandfather. She stayed there, and he came back here to the Rosebud Reservation and continued to work for about 10 years. She was just very religious and very stoic, and lived in a one-room cement block home with a dirt floor, and took care of her two kids. And at one point, you know, my oldest uncle, Chick, was very sick and possibly near death. And she was so religious. She prayed and promised she would go to church, and it was the very first Christian church in Syria. Yes, he lived, and she walked on foot from their village in South Lebanon all the way to this, it's called the Grotto in Sednaya in Syria, to pray and say thanks and walk back. And she was just, I really admired her, the way that her faith and the way that she believed in it. She was just a really tough lady, and that's how, when she came over here, she was a tough part of the family. She kept everybody together and, you know, kept them disciplined and so on.
I wanted to talk with you, Charlie Aberezek, about your father's legacy, and I think part of that legacy is encompassed in your career. Could you tell us a bit about what you learned from him and what you have tried to accomplish out there in South Dakota?
Well, I think, you know, part of, I guess maybe we were a lot alike. And, you know, when I was younger, we butted heads. I wanted to go do my own thing. I felt that he'd chosen his project, and I sort of wanted my own. But he was very, very supportive of that. And I came out here and lived and got involved in the Indian rights struggle on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, you know, during some pretty violent times out here, very intense politically. We had acted as sort of a paralegal helping people with their rights when they were questioned by law enforcement and so on. And that sort of evolved. And later on, when I had, by that time I'd had 8 children with a tribal member, so I decided to go to law school and became active in fighting for Native rights. Most of my clients were individual Indians or Indian tribes or tribal organizations. Later on, I took several positions on the, first on the Supreme Court for the Oglala Sioux Tribe. Then I'm now the Chief Justice for the Rosebud Sioux Tribal Supreme Court. I'm on the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe Supreme Court. And for 3 years, I was the Chief Judge, trial judge for the Oglala Sioux Tribal Court. So I've tried to sort of give back by being involved in on the legal side of things, and of course, I'm always trying to be an advocate for Indian rights and the Indian cause.
Charlie Eberezik, it's been a real pleasure, real honor to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you so much and wish you all the best in your future work. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Alia Eberezik, you're the daughter of Jim Eberezik. We're very, very pleased to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Alia, one of the things that we spoke about with Charlie was your father's wonderful sense of humor. And I think that accounts for his ability to accomplish as much as he did. Can you recall some of the good stories about your dad's sense of humor?
Yeah, of course. I mean, even introducing me, I came into my dad's life when he was 65. So whenever he introduced me to anyone, he liked to follow up by saying, "She's the first baby in South Dakota paid for by Medicare." That was my title for many years. And I mean, my dad's sense of humor is just wonderful. I spent a lot of summers sitting next to my dad at my mom's restaurant, which is downstairs the law office. And anyone that would come into the restaurant, he would just greet with the biggest smile and just, you know, makes them feel so at home. I remember even like as a kid going to a lot of different events that my dad was speaking at, people coming up to me saying just how excited they were for my dad to speak. And of course, I can't remember the details of many of those speeches, but I just remember sitting there and like seeing everyone's eyes just totally glued on my dad and just laughing so hard. Which was such a different, I think, environment, ambiance that was projected in comparison to a lot of the other speakers. Yeah.
What would you say your dad's legacy is? What did he leave behind for us?
Oh, my dad left so much behind for us. You know, today, ICWA was being discussed at the Supreme Court, and that was left untouched, which I just think says a tremendous amount. And someone who spoke at my dad's memorial in Sioux Falls a few weeks ago was a representative of one of the tribes in the Dakotas, and he had never met my dad, but it was just so incredible to hear him speak about the legacy and the protection he's left for the Native people, especially speaking of ICWA and creating all these Native legislations and Native representation also within the Senate and Congress. And in terms of Arab Americans, too, just rewatching some of my dad's speeches that he was giving in the 70s and 80s and realizing how, like, what he was saying back, what, like 50 years ago is still so prevalent today. And also as a Syrian American, having somebody speak up for, or so as a Syrian Lebanese American, having somebody speak up for those people and seeing that fight still continue through others is incredible. And another thing that I've really just been touched by and just am in admiration by, again, is seeing a lot of the people that my dad impacted and how he helped so many people. I bring up the memorial and that a lot of his old staffers and his old intern was there and a few people from ADC, and my dad was working with them when they were around my age right now, and seeing them all accomplish such incredible things and even in their own career make an impact on so many people and individuals, like, that is 100% my dad's legacy, to fight for people who are underrepresented, people who don't have that strong of a voice, and make sure that their voices are heard and continued. And on a very personal note, in Sioux Falls, I spoke about my dad being at the restaurant and how he would just greet everyone as if he had known them for many, many years. And he gave so many people courage to, like just aspire to their largest dreams. And I heard from multiple people that saying that they never thought they could run for any type of elected position, but after speaking to my dad, they had so much confidence to do so. And I think that's such an incredible legacy to live, that you're giving so many people confidence to want to work to help other people, to want to work to be a representative of constituents and a city or a place that they love. And that's really what I hope his legacy continues to be.
Well, thank you very much, Alia Abarezic. Unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time, so we're going to have to say goodbye. But we're very grateful for your joining us on Law & Disorder. You take it easy, and thank you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
We turn to the subject of the criminal justice system, or as a growing number of advocates refer to it, the criminal legal system. One reason for the name change is because it's clear our system of policing, prosecuting, judging, and sentencing rarely brings about justice. After all, our current system grew out of a time where slavery was legal, and only white men with property could participate in public life, including voting. Non-white people were thought of as less than human, and women were afforded little, if any, autonomy apart from the men in their lives. Since then, we've tried to correct course, enacting laws and constitutional amendments that aim to protect everyone equally from the abuse of government power. But today's statistics show that still, in 2023, the criminal legal system does not treat all defendants equally, and not all defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty. Black men, for example, are arrested more, charged more, and given longer sentences than others in similar circumstances. As the founding executive director of Berkeley Law's new Criminal Law and Justice Center, our guest, Chessa Boudin, is embarking on a new journey to study, brainstorm, experiment, and transform for the better how our criminal legal system operates. He is uniquely suited for this new role since he's had experience not only in the public defender's office representing criminal defendants, but also as the former district attorney of San Francisco. And he's unique in the legal profession for another reason. When he was just 14 months of age, he was separated from his parents, radical activists, David Gilbert and Kathy Boudin. They were serving very long prison terms for their part in an armored truck robbery which went astray, and three people were killed. Chessa saw firsthand the harmful impact of incarceration on those inside, as well as on their families, communities, and society as a whole. These experiences informed his studies as a Rhodes Scholar and as a student at Yale, his work as a lawyer, and his life as a devoted husband, father, and son. Thank you so much for joining us today, Chessa Boudin.
Great to be with you, and always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you. Well, first, for our listeners who are not familiar with your history, can you tell us in broad strokes why you ran for the position of District Attorney of San Francisco? What problems were you trying to address?
From the time I was a baby, my parents were incarcerated. I grew up visiting both of my biological parents in prison. And one of the many lessons I learned over the decades of prison visits was that the United States leads the world in locking people up. And I saw firsthand how that system, a system we've come to call mass incarceration, was failing us. It was failing to keep our communities safe. It was failing to rehabilitate people who'd committed crimes. And it was bankrupting state and local governments, depriving them of resources needed to invest in the kinds of things that actually build safety, education and healthcare and housing. I went to law school all those years later in large part because I wanted to build a career fighting against mass incarceration. I became a public defender in San Francisco. And for many years, I did the direct client service work where I represented individual people, often in the most serious crisis of their life, and fought to help keep them out of jail and prison. I saw in the courtrooms everyday injustices, the way the system was designed to discriminate against the poor, against people of color, the way in which it was a case processing machine rather than a system of justice. And so I started doing impact litigation and policy work around immigrants' rights, around wealth inequality, money bail, other issues. And the more I did that work, the more I realized that the district attorney was in a uniquely powerful position to drive policy change, to change the norms around punitive responses to social problems. And in 2019, San Francisco had its first open election, meaning the first time in 110 years when there was no incumbent listed on the ballot for the office of district attorney. That happened to coincide with a national moment, a unique moment in which there was a movement from coast to coast of people running for and winning the office of district attorney in places like Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago and St. Louis and so many others, with an explicit platform around decarceration as a path to safety. And so I ran as part of that movement. I ran really promising voters three core things. First of all, that we would reduce reliance on incarceration. Second, that we would invest in expanding victim services. And third, critically, that we would enforce the law equally, that we would have police accountability, that we would have corporate accountability, that we would hold politicians accountable when they violated the law. And that was the platform I ran on, and that was exactly what I tried to do during my time in office.
Attorney Chase Aboudin, you were able to enact a number of legal reforms during your tenure as DA, such as bail reform. In your opinion, what were your team's biggest successes?
Well, I was really proud of a lot of the work we did. I mean, so much hard work by my team and by the office during a really historically challenging period. The COVID pandemic hit just 2 months after I was sworn into office. But if I had to pick a few examples for you, you know, I'd say one of the things was that we closed a county jail that had been slated for closure for 10 years and that the city had been unable to get around to closing because of jail population issues. We were able to get there. We reduced the number of kids, the number of juveniles in San Francisco detention by over 70%. And we did those things at a time while crime was hitting record lows, both violent and nonviolent crime fell by more than 20% during my tenure. Another area that I'm super proud of and that was a focus throughout my administration was expanding victim services to include things like language access for non-English speaking victims, housing opportunities for survivors of domestic violence, and sponsoring legislation at the state level that is now law that protects sexual assault victims, genetic privacy, and so much more that we did for victims. Finally, an area I'll mention is the work we did to take on the wealthy and the powerful who have come to expect to be able to violate the law with impunity. I mean, we created a worker protection unit that successfully sued gig economy companies for wage theft and misclassification of workers. We charged a number of police officers with homicides and excessive force, and those cases were firsts in San Francisco history. And we also tried to get at the root of things like gun violence, not simply by locking up more young men, but also by suing illegal gun manufacturers, powerful companies profiting off of violence in our communities. Those are some of the kinds of cases that I'm most proud of.
Wow. Well, in enacting those successes, you did encounter some major barriers, I assume. Can you tell us, what were some of the major barriers you'd seen and you continue to see when it comes to creating real and lasting reform in the criminal legal system?
Well, change is hard. And if solving the problems and the failings of our criminal legal system were easy, I'm sure someone would have done it somewhere in this country by now. And you know, and yet we see really deeply entrenched resistance to change. We see fear mongering. We see bureaucratic heel dragging. We see sabotage. You know, I think if I had to be, you know, more specific about where we saw the most resistance from, I would say the San Francisco Police Officers Association. Before I even took office, they spent nearly $1 million attacking me in mailers and TV ads sent to people all across San Francisco. And they did something that sadly has become normal for police unions in this country, which is fear-mongering and race-baiting. And I think, unfortunately, that approach and the massive amount of money they spent contributed to a culture of fear in news coverage and also in political decision-making by folks in City Hall. And so what we saw during my administration and we're continuing to see is that across this country, the criminal justice policy conversation is just simply not being informed by facts or data. Often there's not even any short-term memory. In San Francisco now, we have a mayor who's talking about waging a war on drugs, not on dealers even, but on users, saying that they're going to arrest people who are using drugs on the streets of San Francisco. And, you know, there's no empirical evidence that that's an effective way to deal with or respond to a public health crisis. And, you know, what I was saying since way before I was in office and what I continue to say is we need treatment. We need a medical intervention. We need to invest in resources for harm reduction, for overdose prevention, for drug treatment and mental health services. And until we do those things, the notion that we're going to arrest our way out of a massive decades-long public health crisis, it's just – it's belied by facts and history. And yet we have this systematic refusal from our mayor and from so many others at the local level and state level across the country. A refusal to invest in upstream solutions that actually prevent crime. Housing. We have a housing crisis in San Francisco. Healthcare. Why can't people get treatment on demand? Education. Why are our public schools you know, such a disaster? Employment. Why is it hard for people born and raised in the city, in the Mission District or the Tenderloin, to get good jobs when we are creating and producing so many amazing high-paying jobs in the gig economy? And addiction treatment. If we are concerned, as I am, as we all should be, about the record number of fatal overdoses in San Francisco since the mayor appointed her handpicked district attorney, then why are we relying on them to solve the problem instead of investing in addiction treatment and overdose prevention? You know, the fact that people will not follow the data and instead rely on fear and fear-mongering is really the biggest obstacle we face to building the kinds of safe communities that we all want to raise our families in, the kinds of legal systems that we can honestly and accurately call systems of justice.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my colleague Maria Hall. We're speaking with Attorney Chesa Boudin. Chesa, turning to your new role as the founding executive director of the University of California, Berkeley Law, new Criminal Law and Justice Center, what are your key priorities, and who do you intend to invite to the brainstorming table?
Well, you know, at core, Michael, we're going to research, we're going to educate, and we're going to advocate. And, you know, there's a huge amount of work to do. Criminal justice is such a broad space, broader even than criminal law. It includes conditions of confinement and civil rights and policymaking. And so, you know, I'm just super excited to be in an environment where I'm surrounded by brilliant law professors doing cutting-edge research, digging into data sets and legal theories, and to work with students who are at the outset of their careers, the future judges and public defenders and prosecutors and tenants' rights lawyers and immigration advocates, to be part of shaping the curriculum of these future leaders is a really exciting moment for me. And the center is not just focused inward on student education or programming. It's also focused externally on a wide array of advocacy work and research. So, for example, to give you just some substantive areas that I'm excited to work in this center, bail reform, racial justice, police accountability, victim services, diversion programs, and alternatives to incarceration, as well as you know, local policymaking around things like surveillance, First Amendment protections during protests, there's really no shortage of work that needs to be done, conditions of confinement. And to do that work effectively, we're going to need to not only grow the center and grow its staff so we can take on more projects and more student supervision and more publications, but we're also going to work with a really diverse array of partners locally and nationally. Those partners are going to include, as I mentioned, law professors and students, but also law firms in their pro bono projects. We're going to work with civil rights law firms. We're going to work with nonprofit advocacy groups. We're going to work with currently and formerly incarcerated leaders, elected officials, such as reform prosecutors and our local city council here in Berkeley. And I also, I think it's really important that we remember solving the problems we're facing when it comes to public safety requires an interdisciplinary approach. So I'm committed to not only working with folks at the law school and in the law, but also with medical experts and journalists and data scientists, both right here at the University of California, Berkeley, and practitioners in the field.
The public is so divided about what policies will actually work best to prevent crime. Some demand the harshest punishments, while others seek more positive and restorative solutions. Is there reliable data out there that you can use to inform us about what actually works? And if not, is there a way to start gathering it?
You know, it's a great question. And I want to just start by saying we definitely need more better information and data. And that's a key part of what my center will do. We're going to gather data, we're going to analyze it, and we're going to publish it. But it's also true at a high level that, you know, we actually do know what works and what doesn't work at a high level. One of the things that's been so frustrating to me in my career is that, you know, we've had a many decades long experiment in this country with mass incarceration, with locking up more people for longer than any other country in the world at a greater cost and with worse results. We know that about 2/3 of people getting out of prison in this country will be rearrested, reincarcerated within a couple of years. In other words, it's not working. I mean, you know, imagine any other area of government. Imagine a surgery that failed 2/3 of the time. You wouldn't keep doing that surgery, would you? And so we have decades worth of data showing that mass incarceration is a failure. And again, this is by any metric, financial, human, safety. Why do folks who claim to be interested in data-driven approaches ignore that evidence, the evidence that the status quo is a disaster, and say they're curious to see data, more data, better data about alternatives to incarceration? I want to just tell you one example of something that we did in the San Francisco DA's office when I was district attorney and actually before my time as well. We had a program that was a juvenile restorative justice program. And basically the way it worked was as follows. We did this as an A-B study with an outside independent data auditor for many years. We took all eligible juvenile cases that we were filing. And in group A, we prosecuted them as we normally would. And in group B, we reached out to the victim of the crime and we gave them the chance to participate in a restorative justice approach, an approach where the outcome was not a conviction or adjudication against the minor, but rather a healing process that was driven by the harm that had been caused and what the victim felt they needed to heal and be made whole. It was a long-term process. It wasn't a single meeting or a letter of apology. It often involved months or sometimes years of work by the minor, by the juvenile. What we found was that upwards of 90% of people, of victims, who were given the choice to participate in restorative justice chose it over traditional prosecution. And more importantly still, when we did analysis over many years, we found that the minors, the kids, the people accused of committing these crimes were far less likely to be rearrested after successfully completing restorative justice than after successfully completing a jail sentence or traditional sentence imposed by a judge. And the victims had satisfaction at a much higher rate. They felt that they had been healed, that the system had served them. In other words, by any metric, restorative justice was doing a better job keeping us safer, making victims feel that their needs had been addressed, and reducing costs, financial costs to the system. It's a no-brainer. And yet there is tremendous resistance from police and from people who want to carry the tough on crime banner from implementing these kinds of policies. So yes, we have data and we have a very big picture sense of what is working, what is not working, and what the costs are. And yet we still see resistance to moving in that direction, even to doing pilot projects that could help us gather more specific data and fine tune these kinds of policies in ways that I hope our center will be able to do.
Chase Boudin, on May 21, 2023, a Contra Costa County judge issued a landmark decision finding proof of racial bias and racism in the decisions of Contra Costa County DA's office, using a relatively new California law called the Racial Justice for All Act. What are your thoughts about this new law? Will it change the way prosecuting is done?
Well, this law has the potential to be a sea change. It allows, in summary, it allows defendants, current or prior, it has retroactive applicability, to obtain data and seek remedies. And I want to be clear, those remedies are not always full dismissal of the case, for correcting the deeply embedded racial bias that we know permeates every stage of the criminal legal system. This law is going to shed a light on law enforcement practices that for far too long have been a black box. It's going to allow defendants to get sentences reduced in some cases, to get charges modified in other cases. It is going to require, in order for defendants to obtain relief, a very different legal standard than the U.S. Supreme Court in the McCleskey v. Kemp case set out. In that case, in essence, people alleging discrimination were required to show specific intentional discrimination in their case. The Racial Justice Act, by contrast, acknowledges that there's pervasive implicit bias and systemic bias that may not be specific to one individual or may not be provable as intentional against that individual. It's enough under the Racial Justice Act, in other words, to simply show that kind of implicit or systemic bias had an impact on the case. In other words, the potential for what it could mean for criminal practice in California is really massive. And I want to commend the Contra Costa district attorney because Dinah Becton, the elected district attorney in Contra Costa, whose office lost the motion that you're describing and had a court rule that they had to modify the charges in that case, instead of doubling down, instead of playing identity politics, she is an African-American woman, instead of going straight to the Court of Appeal, she said, look, if the data shows that there's a history of discrimination or bias in the way that these allegations are being used in cases, we want to do a holistic review of our own cases. We want to take a look under the hood and see if there's ways we can make positive changes. So she's leaning in to the law. She's leaning into eliminating racial disparities. And I think that's exactly what we need to see from district attorneys across the state.
Well, speaking of prosecutors, in the past few years, a number of progressive prosecutors have been elected around the country, including George Gascon in my hometown of Los Angeles, who narrowly avoided a recall, Pamela Price in Alameda County, which includes Oakland, who's attacked constantly in the press, and Kim Fox in Cook County, who just announced she will not run again after serving two terms. Being a progressive prosecutor is certainly a tough job, to be under constant political and personal attack. What advice do you have to current or would-be progressive prosecutors, given that there are so few role models and really no defined career path to get there?
This is not an easy job. If it were easy, somebody would have already done it. And if you're someone who is serious about system change, if you're someone who is principled in the face of tremendous pressure and corruption and deeply entrenched impunity for those in power, then you have to be prepared for the system to try to tear you down and shut you up. Taking on police unions and billionaires in their boardrooms, taking on gun manufacturers and corrupt city halls, that makes you powerful enemies. And they will attack you and they will undermine you every step of the way. And they've got the resources and the networks and the lawyers and the media platforms to do it. But remember, if your cause is just, and this movement is certainly on the right side of history, then it is worth the fight. Martin Luther King said it very well when he said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice."
Your late mother, my dear friend Kathy Boudin, was one of the founders of the Center for Justice at Columbia University. It's not coincidental that you're calling your program at Berkeley by a similar name. What was it that your mother was doing that you would like to replicate?
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to be the founding executive director of the University of California Berkeley Law, Criminal Law and Justice Center. Our Criminal Law and Justice Center, as you say, has a similar name to my mother's Center for Justice at Columbia University School of Social Work. And, you know, as you know, Michael, and really so many people know, my mom was truly one of a kind. Everybody who had a relationship with her, who interacted with her, was touched by her compassion, her energy, her generosity of spirit. She's one of those people who had hundreds of best friends. And her approach at her center for justice, is really a great one to draw inspiration from. She and her team, largely led by formerly incarcerated women, were creative and principled and community engaged. Their approach to advocacy was democratic and participatory. It was outside the box thinking. And so as I set out on my own path, in my own new job at Berkeley Law School's Criminal Law and Justice Center, I'm focused on trying to channel that energy, creativity, that passion and compassion. And I'm excited to be doing it in a law school where I can help to educate and launch the careers of the next generation of leaders and advocates.
Attorney Chesa Boudin, it's been wonderful to talk to you today. How can our listeners learn more about your work at Berkeley Law School, and how can they follow it and what in the work that you're doing?
You can check us out on social media at Berkeley Law CLJC, and that's Twitter or Instagram, Berkeley Law CLJC. You can follow me personally at Chesa Boudin on Twitter and Instagram as well.
Well, this has been great talking to you, Chesa. Thank you very much for the interview. Thank you very much for your good work. Every success in the future.
Thank you so much, Michael. Always a pleasure to be with you and the team, and look forward to coming back on again to share some of our initial projects.
For sure. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and gone? And will I be How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, need.